I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Jack Wang has just published a short story collection, his debut, We Two Alone. The stories in the novella In It portray the Chinese diaspora in various points of time and place throughout 100 years, from roughly the 1920s to the present. The stories take place in various places and feature a disparate group of characters, be they educated or not, members of the elite or disenfranchised. Some of the characters are disadvantaged. Some are contending with issues of identity, morality, and intimacy. Jack joins me now to talk about his stories, his collection, and writing. I'll ask him about how and where he writes, as well as what he wanted to illuminate in these fascinating characters and unforgettable stories. It is an important book, and that has been said to be a powerful debut from a writer we'll be reading lots of from over the years. This Sunday afternoon, Jack will be participating in an event with the Vancouver Writers Fest. He'll be one of the writers at this year's virtual afternoon tea hosted by Bill Richardson. Jack grew up in Vancouver, but joined me from his home in Ithaca, New York, where he is an associate professor in the Department of Writing at Ithaca College. He was educated at the University of Toronto, the University of Arizona, and Florida State University, where he received his PhD with an emphasis in creative writing. The Twitter handle is @JackWangAuthor. This new book is published by House of Anansi Press. We taped this interview 10 days ago. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Jack Wang. Professor Wang, good morning.
Hi, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. There's an event at the Writers Fest Sunday, the 25th of October. It's a hometown appearance in a way. I know you'll be, remote. All of you will be on Zoom.
Right.
If this was any other year, I guess you'd have made the trip back. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely would have made it back for the hometown Lit Fest. So it's definitely a shame. But I'm looking forward to it nonetheless.
But before all of this, before COVID, did you get back often here?
Yeah, I would go back to Vancouver regularly, at least once a year.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I was supposed to be there for 2 months this summer at Joy Kagawa House. I had a two-month residency at Joy Kagawa House, and unfortunately that had to be, deferred for a couple of years because they're renovating next summer, so I can't just come back next summer. But, yeah, there were all kinds of plans were scuttled. I was supposed to travel for a number of literary festivals in B.C., all of which went remote. So
The book is described as your debut collection, but you've written other books before, right?
Well, I have published many books, but all of them were in the realm of children's literature. My brother and I did a couple of board book series. One's called Cozy Classics, and another one's called Star Wars Epic Yarns. So those were for the youngest of readers. This is actually my first book of adult literary fiction.
And I understand that some of these stories have appeared in other publications, is that right?
That's right. They've, appeared in a number of, major Canadian literary journals. They've been shortlisted for the Commonwealth Short Story Prize and longlisted for the Journey Prize and anthologized accordingly. So the stories have appeared elsewhere, and now they're finally in book form.
And so do you edit or, add to some of those previous stories prior to putting them in a collection like We Two Alone?
Yeah, so, I put together the collection based on the stories that I had published. Most of the stories, by the time I sent out to agents, were already published, and I had what I imagined was a complete collection, but the editorial process, after House of Anansi had acquired my collection, my editor, Janie Yoon, who's a wonderful editor, she actually asked me to add a story. And there was a temporal gap between two stories because these stories are about the Chinese diaspora over about 100 years, but there were, two stories that kind of, there was kind of a large temporal gap between them. So I was given a charge to add a story set in the 50s, 60s, or 70s, and I wound up adding a story set in South Africa right in the middle of the collection. So um, this, the collection did evolve in the editorial process, but they were mostly as I had imagined them, you know, when I sent off to agents.
The fascinating thing about reading the book is, as you mentioned, they're all about people of the Chinese diaspora. But, you know, my parents are Filipino. I mean, I was mm-hmm. born and grew up in Vancouver. But I don't know how to put this. At some point, as I'm reading the stories, I sort of forgot that they were Chinese in a way. In some situations, you know, I read oneself into, you know, the circumstance that they get into or some feeling that they have. I saw that there was a tweet about the collection. I can't remember who it was. But then they added the hashtag representation matters. And right. It's not that... I guess these characters are Chinese per se. It's that they are. These are situations that anybody, or any group of people would endure or go through, experience.
Right.
But they just happen to be, you know, Asian, say.
Right. Right. Yeah. You make a good point. And on the one hand, these characters, they are particular. You know, they happen for the most part to be Chinese and to be about the Chinese immigrant experience. But, you know, literary characters are always metaphors at the same time. And so they're stand-ins for, you know, the universal human experience. And so on the one hand, other immigrants, I hope, can recognize themselves in these stories. But, you know, representation does matter, but at the same time, diverse stories alone aren't enough. If people aren't reading, you know, diverse literature or literature by authors of color, not reading their characters as stand-in for universal humanness. You know, if you read diverse stories and they're just sort of exotic detours from what you consider universal humanity, then it's actually not really making that much of a difference. But if you're able to see yourself, you know, in the characters you read, no matter what background they might be from, then I think, you know, we can recognize our common humanity.
So representation does matter because literary culture especially has a long way to go, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does. You know, I think that... the American Pulitzer Prize winner Viet Thanh Nguyen, he talks about the idea of narrative scarcity in literature and film and television, and certainly as someone who grew up in the 70s and 80s, I faced a lot of narrative scarcity. I didn't see myself very much in the books I read, certainly not in the movies I watched and the television I watched. And so, you know, part of the project, part of my impetus to write is, you know, to see myself reflected in literature, to see my own reality captured in fiction. And, you know, when I think about these stories being read, I think about, for example, you know, a version of myself that's younger, who is perhaps taking some solace in the fact that they see their own experience mirrored in the fiction that they're reading. And it might encourage them to create stories of their own. So, representation does matter, but it's important at the same time that, you know, everyone reads diverse literature as representative, as I say, of a universal humanity.
Yeah, one wouldn't think if we've read something about World War II or about apartheid South Africa.
Right.
We wouldn't have thought of, most people I would think, say, a Chinese character or a person in that setting.
Right.
And so
right.
What was it like for you, the writer, to not only take these various settings that you do in the collection, and, I mean, it sounds crass, but I don't mean it that way. I mean, insert these certain characters in those situations or in those places of time, say.
Right. Yeah, you know, the Chinese diaspora is just so vast, and there are just so many stories of the Chinese diaspora. You know, Chinese have migrated to you know, every corner of the globe, and there are so many, you know, underreported, underappreciated stories out there, and I think part of the goal of the collection was to tell a few of those stories to understand that, you know, Chinese have been coming to the West for a long time, and they have, for example, you know, migrated to, you know, many parts of Africa, including South Africa, and did suffer under apartheid, and occupied this kind of liminal space between black and white in that country. And, you know, we don't often think of Chinese being involved in the European theater of the Second World War or the years leading up to the Second World War. But as you're alluding to, one of my stories is about the Consul General of China in Vienna, who wrote exit visas for Jewish Austrians around the time of Kristallnacht, or the Night of Broken Glass, mm-hmm. which is the title of the story. And so, you know, I have stories set in England, you know, stories set in the U.S., stories set in China. And I'm just trying to gesture at just how many stories are out there you know, deserve to be told.
There's a great attention to detail in the stories that I found just delightful and fascinating. That obviously involves a certain amount of research on your part. It's just not writing, I suppose, when you're writing these stories. So how would you research this stuff? Or did you have heretofore an interest in a particular place and know some of the details, say?
Yeah, so I did do a lot of research for these stories. And some places I had some firsthand experience with. For example, one story is set in England, in Oxford and London, both places, you know, I've spent some time in. And so on the one hand, I was drawing from my own experience. But even for a story like that, I still did a lot of research. The story is about a Chinese-British student at Oxford whose family runs a Chinese takeaway. And you know, I don't know much about it, so I read some obscure dissertations about Chinese takeaways in the UK in the 80s and 90s, for example.
Uh-huh.
And all of these books, all of these stories required usually reading a couple of books. You know, when I write about things like the Sino-Japanese War or Kristallnacht or, you know, the Chinese under apartheid, these were not things that I already knew, but things I wanted to know. And things I wanted to write about. So I had to, you know, teach myself before and to build that model of reality in my own mind before I could convincingly create a world for anybody else.
What kind of desk do you write at?
What kind of desk do I write at?
Yeah.
I write at, you know, it's funny because my office is a little writer's garret, but it's actually in a walk-in closet. We had some renos done a couple years ago. We had a walk-through closet, but we enclosed it, and it's basically a little windowless office. And I work at a kind of a kind of mid-century modern desk, uh-huh. although it's not authentically mid-century modern. But it's in this little writer's garret, and when I close the door and I hole up, it's my own little world, and I can retreat into, you know, my imagination.
Do you read at the desk?
Sometimes I read at the desk. I also have, you know, another little reading nook that has a window and it's a little better lit than my writer's garret. But yeah, this is where I hole up to do most of my composing.
I thought of that to ask you about what your desk is because I just walked by a shelf at the house and I saw Robert Caro's book, and mm-hmm. he talks about I think he actually built the desk or had it built to his specifications because he wanted it a certain way, and you know, writers like yourself, you know, have certain places where they actually write, And then, you know, you hear, I see this on Twitter all the time, writers writing saying coffee shops and the sort. And I've always wondered how it works as a writer.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I know a lot of people who wouldn't be able to work in the office that I'm working in because it is windowless and, you know, you can't look outside. There's, you know, you're completely locked away. But for me, you know, I like that feeling of total retreat, totally shutting off the outside world so I can totally immerse myself in, you know, I mean, I do read at the desk to the extent that I'm doing research here and just immerse myself in my own fictional world. But I know a lot of people, and I can't handle the distraction of a coffee shop, all that kind of traffic, human or otherwise, going on around me. I really need the focus, which is probably why I can work in this kind of hermetically sealed space.
Does it must feel isolating, say, being there with a blank page or whatever, or a screen even. Is it?
Yeah. You know, writing is, by its nature, a pretty solitary act. And I suppose some people need respite from that solitude, whereas other people embrace that solitude and enjoy that solitude. And I think for the moments that I'm in my office, I'm definitely, you know, embracing it and getting in the zone.
I did feel like I was in a sort of lonely zone reading the stories, because I suppose a lot of the characters, you illustrate so well that feeling that they have of, say, loneliness or isolation. A lot of these characters are separated from what they want or who they want. I don't know. That same feeling, I guess, is what a lot of people are feeling today. So it doesn't really matter if the story, say, takes place 100 years ago. Remains relevant.
Right. Yeah, the title story is We Two Alone, and it comes from a line from King Lear, "We two alone will sing like birds in a cage." And every story takes love, whether it's a relationship or a marriage or a broken marriage, as, you know, the heart of the story. And so, you know, the story is, on the one hand, very much about love and loss and longing, all the things that have to do with love and desire. But, of course, there's also the solitude and the loneliness of, you know, being in a new place and the different kinds of estrangements one can feel if one doesn't feel entirely of the society in which, you know, one lives. And so I think that there is that sense. I was trying to capture that sense of both solitude and loneliness. And maybe my own temperament is also, you know, fictionally a little bit melancholic or something. But maybe that's the tone that you're describing. But especially since, you know, I'm trying to aspire to, you know, some hard truths. Things don't always work out well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, relationships don't always succeed. And, you know, that's part of the beautiful sadness of being human.
Race is something that you touch upon throughout the book. And
sure.
What's refreshing about it is that it is very nuanced in that it's not easy. And then you realize, yeah, sure, it's not easy in life itself, is it?
Right.
You illustrate how it can be internalized as it is. There is a reason for it, and it affects it's a product of other inequalities in society, a little bit of class or gender. When you think about race and racism itself, I mean, I go back to that thing I just mentioned a moment ago, that a story set 100 years ago still resonates in that sense. And, you know, things get better, but then I guess history is cyclical, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, I found myself saying quite a bit recently that the past is always the present. And there's actually a line in the story Belleside Park that, you know, just to paraphrase myself,
yeah.
But the character thinks time is not a line but a sign or a wave forever vacillating. So, you know, it's not like progress just goes in one direction and then never goes backwards. And, you know, we're seeing that in this current political moment, especially, you know, I live in the United States right now. And so, you know, the nativism and the nationalism and, you know, the anti-Asian sentiments that arose out of COVID, all of these things feel like, you know, that line is vacillating. And so when I wrote about, you know, the past 100 years, you know, the racism is more overt 100 years ago, you know, in the story set in 1920, for example.
Yeah.
The early stories, you know, there's a lot more overt racism. The characters have to fear for, you know, their lives frequently. They have to fear bodily harm. And then the last story, which is about an actor, is about more contemporary issues like issues of representation, as we were talking about. An actor who's trying to make meaningful movies, tell meaningful stories, trying to get hired as an actor in a world of narrative scarcity. And so, you know, that's a more, arguably a more subtle sort of issue. So the story is trying to trace the changing nature of racism, but as you say, also the ways that they intersect with gender and class, sexual orientation, because, you know, one is never only just Chinese or any, you know, other ethnicity.
Right.
One is also
mm-hmm.
Many other things at once, and so those things have a very complex interplay. So sometimes the things that Asian women struggle with, for example, in the story, are a little different than, you know, the Asian men, for example. And so, you know, I'm trying to be mindful of the interplay of all those different forces that work on us.
What's your relationship to the characters in the stories? I'm sure you like a lot of them. Are there ones that you didn't like, say?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think that, you know, I do feel sympathy for all of them. And, you know, I think that they're probably little broken bits of myself in all of them, no matter how seemingly different they are.
Mm-hmm.
It is interesting to me that somebody, you know, recently described the protagonist of a story called All Hallows. This is a guy who is a washed-up hockey player. He aspired mm-hmm. to be a professional hockey player. He doesn't make it. He's divorced from his wife, but he's still in love with him. But, you know, this I heard someone describe his character as a blazing F-up, you know, which
mm-hmm.
I actually really enjoyed. I really enjoyed that description because, you know, he defies type a little bit of the model minority and, you know,
yeah.
Asians always having to be successful. I mean, the guy is a failure. He makes some pretty bad mistakes. And but it's for that reason that I like him actually and feel sympathetic because, you know, he's human. He has his foibles. But you know, no matter how flawed some of these characters may be, I find them endearing for it.
So this collection, We Two Alone, has short stories in them,
mm-hmm.
in it, as well as a novella.
That's right.
The title of the book comes from that. I understand that you're writing a novel now.
That's right. That's right.
Is the mindset different when you're writing, say, a short story as opposed to a novella, as opposed to a novel?
Yeah, I think the mindset is quite different. It's much easier because of its length to, you know, hold on to the entire arc of a short story in your mind at once and to see it whole. And for someone like me who tends to revise a great deal and even to be a bit of a perfectionist, it's easier at that scale, you know, to work and rework, and you hold everything in your mind at once. And, you know, it's possible to polish, in other words, fairly relentlessly, because you can see everything in your mind at once. So the novel, the scale is such that you're writing, you're working, and frankly, you forget the things you wrote earlier on because you're just so focused on the things you're working on now. And, of course, when you're in the midst of your first draft, you don't even see that whole scale yet. So you're working in the dark constantly. And as the metaphor goes, it's like driving in the dark. You can get to your destination, but you can only see as far as your headlights, you know, and you only see so far in front of you. You know you're going somewhere, but you can't see the whole thing. And so, you know, it's hard to contain it all at once in your mind. And so the feeling of the material that you're working with is just a little different.
Are you one of these writers who can write quickly, say? I mean, you mentioned the revision process, and I'm fascinated
right.
about that, because some people can write very quickly, and then the revision process can take a very long time. Because writing, as we've all found out, is just as much rewriting as writing itself. How have you found the way you work, and is it comparable, say, to other writers?
Yeah, I'm a pretty slow writer, and I often think of writing as an art for the slow-minded, in the sense that, you know, people who are really witty and quick-tongued and, you know, have a really sharp mind, you know, they're the stand-up comics of the world. They're people who have to, you know, think on their feet instantaneously. But, you know, a writer, when you're looking at a finished short story, you shouldn't be able to tell if it took one sitting or 100 sittings. It should seem like a complete thing, as it was meant to be. But you can erase your tracks, and you can't tell how long it took and how slow-minded the writer, you know, was. And I am a very, you know, iterative writer, and I think of writing and rewriting, as I've said before, is a kind of Darwin machine. And a Darwin machine is anything that mimics the process of natural selection. So writing is kind of like that, in that you generate, you select, and then you regenerate constantly, cycle after cycle. And then complex forms can emerge from simpler ones. But that process doesn't work, at least not for me, unless you really go through a lot of iterations. And so for me, yeah, writing is a bit slow. And, you know, I have the worst kind of personality, which is, for writing, which is that I'm a perfectionist. So that makes me go through that iterative process even more, draft after draft. But hopefully when people are reading the collection, reading the stories, you know, hopefully they can't tell if it was, you know, one sitting or 100.
You teach full-time. I'm assuming that doesn't afford you as much time to write, or does it?
Well, it's challenging, of course, during the academic year. When you're teaching, I was actually supposed to be on sabbatical this fall, you know, partly to write and partly to support the book on tour and so on, but all of the sabbaticals at my college were deferred, and I was pulled back into the classroom. So, you know, I certainly have less time at the moment than I would have had otherwise. But, you know, that said, compared to other professions, scholarship is part of my job, so it is part of, you know, my workload to write. And so to that extent, it's a more helpful profession than others might be.
I mentioned this novel that you're working on now. I've seen in articles or pieces written about you, what that's about. Are you able to tell us just a little bit about what it's about, say?
Sure. I'm happy to talk about it. I'm not superstitious, as some writers are, about talking about their next project, as if they'll jinx it. But I'm writing about Chinese Canadians who served during the Second World War. Mm. And, you know, the interesting thing is that because the Chinese didn't have the franchise at the outset of the war, they were actually barred from military service because the government feared that the Chinese, having served, would then demand the franchise, which, of course, was a motive to earn the franchise. But the interesting thing was that eventually, due to just the need for people to serve, Chinese were eventually admitted into, you know, the various branches of the military and served in various theaters, including Special Operations Executive. This was a civilian authority started by Churchill to foment resistance behind enemy lines in Europe, but eventually it became operational in Asia. But unlike in Europe, where, you know, it was easy to find agents who were European, who could pass, who could speak the language, suddenly they needed folks who could pass in Asia, who could speak the language, the native language, local language, but also be loyal to Canada and the Allied cause. And suddenly Chinese Canadians were valued for that role. So it's it was an interesting irony, and I wanted to dramatize this because, you know, I think a lot of Canadians, including Chinese Canadians, may not be familiar with this history.
Yeah, I guess they're replacing the Patullo Bridge here. And,
oh, yeah, right, right, yeah.
It was in the news this week that the new bridge, there is a lot of people, I should say, do not want the new bridge to bear that name because of things he said or did during the Second World War, not just towards the Chinese, but Jews, for example.
Right, right.
And
right.
People brought up Douglas Jung and stuff that he said in terms of why he wanted to serve.
Right, right. Yeah, he was, of course, one of the folks who was also in Special Operations Executive. But Patullo, of course, he was averse to giving the Chinese the franchise and so on. So I am fine with naming the bridge after somebody else.
Right, right. The other thing I wanted to ask you, I know authors, when they put out collections, take a lot of time in terms of ordering the book. I got the book, I guess, in the spring. And I knew I was going to talk to you probably in the fall, so I knew I had time with it. But so I went through the book and I found, say, the shortest story and started there and moved around. I guess that's not a way that you'd advise readers to take. I suppose. I mean, they should read it the way that you've ordered it, right?
Well, that's interesting. That you know, I guess people do. Pick and choose in a collection, you know, the order in which they'd like to read. I guess kind of like, you know, listening to an album and just jumping around to different tracks. I think that if you read this collection in order, you would see the particular way it was arranged. And it was mainly arranged in chronological order so that people could see that kind of changing trajectory of the Chinese diaspora over a century. But I think that, you know, even if you read the story in a different order, that would probably still be the cumulative effect by the end.
Yeah, so I went back to looking at the book again this past weekend.
Yeah.
Preparing for our chat.
Right.
And I ended up starting from the beginning and then rereading parts of it, did find something. I did find things new that I didn't read, that I didn't see in the first reading, and
That's interesting.
And then now talking to you, I do think that I probably would have been, I don't know if better serve is the right word, but I think I would have gotten something else if had I read it cover to cover. Say,
yeah, I mean, certainly with collections, usually there's, you know, some intention behind the order. Not on like an album, say. And in my case, you know, it was perhaps particularly intentional because the stories are so thematically related. One could have a short story collection where the stories are much more disparate and sort of the assemblage of themes much more loose. But in this case, they're fairly tightly bound, and so there may be something to be gain from reading them in the order in which they were laid out. Yeah.
I've so enjoyed speaking with you today, Jack. Congratulations on this book. It's an important book, an important collection, and continued good luck with it. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Joe. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
The Twitter handle is at Jack Wang, author. The collection is called We Two Alone. It is published by House of Anansi Press. Jack Wang joined me on the line from Ithaca, New York. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plato.